go spread the word. When you get a fresh, hot McCrispy from McDonald's and you can feel the heat coming through the bag, don't try to wait till you get home. Always respect hot chicken. The McCrispy, only at McDonald's. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
Explore the world's hidden wonders on the Atlas Obscura podcast. A village in India where everyone's name is a song. A boiling river in the Amazon. A spacecraft cemetery in the middle of the ocean. Every day, the Atlas Obscura podcast will blow your mind in 15 minutes. You can find it on the SiriusXM app, Pandora, or wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to follow the show so you never miss an episode.
Hi, I'm LeVar Burton, and this is LeVar Burton Reads. In every episode, I handpick a different piece of short fiction, and I read it to you. The only thing these stories have in common is that I love them, and I hope you will too. Every once in a while, I read a story that activates every part of my soul. A story that motivates me, that fuels me. This, y'all, is one of those stories. It's about parenting and race and violence and the pain of being unable to protect your child from a violent world. "The World Wasn't Ready for You" is the titular story from Justin C. Key's debut story collection. Now, Justin is a practicing psychiatrist as well as a writer. And let me tell you, he is one writer to watch. He has my full attention. The story is set in a future where an alien mothership floats alongside Earth. The Keplins, those aliens, are an interstellar race with incredible abilities. They have minds that can interface in surprising ways with technology, skin that changes color with their moods, the gift of telepathy. Their telepathy is called yunctio. It's a Latin word that means joining and usually refers to the joining of hands. In this case, however, it's about the joining of minds, and it's made possible by the close bonds that Keplins are able to create in their relationships. Our protagonist is a widowed black man, a father, who is raising his half-Keplin son, trying to keep him safe and happy and healthy in a world that treats him like a second-class citizen. And worse. Please check out the content advisory in the episode description if you are so inclined. And now, if you're ready, let's take a deep breath. And begin. "The World Wasn't Ready for You" by Justin C. Key. Moments before she passed, my wife winced from the still raw pain of a long labor as she tried to rise from the couch. I assured her that our newborn, asleep in the other room, was fine. Jordan's entry into this world had been far from normal. We all needed time to rest. "He was so good," my wife said as I settled beside her. She squeezed my hand, but her gaze was off elsewhere. "The world just wasn't ready." It was a lifetime before I knew what she meant.
I can't breathe.
I placed my hand on my son's chest to sense a rise and fall. Nothing. Cold, soft, unmoving. I tried to put Jordan over my shoulder, but he had grown heavy somewhere along the way. Inhaler. I needed his inhaler. He was going transparent, fast. I patted his muscled back. He waved me off. I kneeled down beside him and tried to help him to his feet, but something kept him down. I can't breathe. I tried to pry merciless fingers from stifled locks. I gasped up and out of the fog of sleep, remembered myself and where I was, when I was. My room was empty, quiet. Just like the house that felt 10 times too big ever since Jordan left home a few years back when he turned 21. Jordan, something was happening. I reached for my phone while trying to remember if he would be working on Reliance this week or next. No answer. Maybe he was on the ship. Then I remembered the travel ban, how I had just seen him a couple of days before. For dinner. Calm down, Drew. I was freaking myself out. Quickly, I saw that wasn't the truth. Not completely. These emotions weren't mine. They were Jordan's. His despair stretched out unmitigated across whatever distance separated us. I fought an old urge to run into his room. I focused. I can't breathe. An asthma attack? Lung failure after years of overworked compensation for the scarring during birth? No, this was different. Something was keeping him from breathing. I felt his struggle, almost as if that oppressive something were me. Something, someone, was doing this to his body. I called to him. Our Yungcho had grown weak from the years of estrangement and had only begun to strengthen under our recent reconciliation. It was like trying to communicate through a thin crack in a soundproof wall. Would I sit there screaming helplessly as my son died from something I couldn't even see? No, I wouldn't. I couldn't save him. That truth came fast and strong, like the cold realization that his mother, lying dead in our bed 2 decades before, was beyond helping. I could either act or spend the rest of my life regretting what I did in the last moments of my son's life. I reached across the Yungtyo, past the force oppressing him, past his gasping locks, and stroked his head in the same way I had first done in the neonatal ICU. The texture of his locks were real on my fingers, the warmth of his life as cogent as the fear of losing it. Jordan felt me as I felt him. Hot concrete scratched against his cheek. Something hard and blunt pressed into his back. Dark words barked into his ear, a threat of death. It was the tight grip on his locks, however, that was killing him. I had let them grow thick and long in his childhood to act as a second set of lungs. Often, peace officers tied up a Keplin suspect's locks during a detainment because they were considered weapons. With this connection, I felt my own throat close. I swallowed against it to show myself I could still breathe despite the sensation. With everything in me, I began to sing. Down by the river where the kids play. Serenity coated my son's mind as his labored breathing slowed. He struggled against his captors enough to get in one last breath to call out for me. I nearly unwound. I didn't have to tell him I couldn't help. My silence was enough. And then, all was still. 5. While most of the other parents sat in tranquility, I walked along the perimeter of the playground, watching. Jordan was a sweet kid, and a mindful one, but at times he would get excited and forget he wasn't the only one trying to have fun. Though he was neither, a large swath of the earthbound population saw Keplins as aggressive and unruly. Marlena and I had somewhat protected ourselves from this by putting roots down in one of the most progressive cities in the country. Still, seeing as how I hadn't met any other interstellar families in our neighborhood, I didn't trust anyone to give Jordan the benefit of the doubt he deserved. My mind began to wander how I was going to get my company's Keplin marketing initiative done, and if I had taken any meat out to defrost for dinner, when I snapped back to see a kid pushing past Jordan up the ladder. Though the kid looked similar in age, Jordan was thin and light. His hair was the biggest thing on his body. "Take turns. Let him go up," I said. Jordan did, and I could tell by the decolorization of his skin that he wasn't happy about it. The other kid waited at the top. When he blocked the slide entrance, Jordan instead spun the adjacent toy steering wheel. The kid lunged forward to turn it the other direction. I looked around for a potential parent. A man with short, wavy hair and folded arms sat on a nearby bench. His enhancement glasses blinked a dull orange to indicate that he was somewhere else entirely. He had no clue his kid was being a jerk. Jordan abruptly abandoned the battle over the steering wheel and went for the slide. The other kid failed to beat him to it. I almost cheered until I saw him zipping down behind Jordan and just miss kicking him in the back.
"Hey, play nice," I said.
The kid's father didn't stir. Jordan ran back around to the ladder. The other boy was there a moment later. His shoulder sent Jordan stumbling. Jordan bounced up and we both ran forward. I wouldn't let my 5-year-old son roll around in the shaved wood with some stranger asshole kid, but Jordan had other things in mind. He grabbed the metal of the ladder and it disappeared. Just like that. The boy who had been halfway up stopped as if someone had pressed life's pause button. He looked at his hands impossibly gripping air, his feet standing on nothing. Naturally, he began to yell,
"Daddy! Daddy!"
Finally, his father came back to reality. Other parents began to stare. Some gathered up their children. Though the kid bawling on the invisible ladder had been the aggressor, they would see my son as the danger because of what he was. Jordan backed into me, the ladder reappearing with his release, and pulled my arms around him as he looked up at the boy. I wasn't sure if Keplin jeans coded a skin tone for self-admiration, but this had to be close.
"You ready to get some ice cream?"
I asked. He was. After we were well on the road, I asked another question.
"Did you do that on purpose?"
Jordan looked out the window. I asked again.
"It was an accident,"
he said.
"It's okay if it wasn't. He deserved it."
At the next red light, I turned to match eyes with him.
"But don't do it often, okay? Some people might not be too happy about it."
"Like the mind talk?"
"Yes, just like that."
"Because it's bad?"
"No, because people might not understand it. People don't like things they don't understand."
"Okay."
He picked at his fingernails, a childhood habit of mine that had somehow been passed down.
"Did you see how he froze in place?"
I said through the rear view.
Red giggled his skin.
I thought he turned into a statue.
Red and blue lights popped into our world. My heart pumped with preparatory fear even before I recognized the unwelcome blare of peace officers.
Are they coming to arrest me?
Jordan said. He sat up, his tones purpled.
Because I did the bad thing? No one's going to arrest you,
I said.
How do you know? Because I just do, Jordan.
Where had he picked this up? I remembered my father's unspoken angst whenever a police car approached, how it had poisoned our car's air and made it unbreathable. I worked to protect Jordan from my own unease. Maybe he felt it anyway, through our yungcho. Maybe he sensed that a primal part of me had, for a second, wondered if they were coming for him. The patrol car passed. I let out a breath I didn't realize I was holding. The vehicle it pulled over was low to the ground, slim and tubular. With their mental connection to the technology we had appropriated, Keplins had no need for steering wheels, which made them easy to spot. The peace officer was black, like me, and I found myself wondering what the Keplin had done wrong. I smiled through the rear view.
See? I told you.
Jordan's locks curled like dead spider legs over his increasingly translucent face. His chest heaved in forced jerks. His nostrils flared.
I can't breathe.
I pulled into the next driveway, parked, and emptied Jordan's bag. Shit. I must have left his inhaler at home. I climbed through the middle into the back, unbuckled his seatbelt, and maneuvered him into my lap. His locks expanded against my fingers as I untangled them. The wheezing lessened. His digging fingernails relaxed on my thigh.
Breathe,
I said.
Breathe.
I still had quite a bit of untangling to do, but found my own breathing calmed from the relief. And so, sitting there in the back seat of the car, cramped against his booster seat, I began to sing for the both of us.
Down by the river, where the kids play, laughter and sunshine till the new day.
I ran my fingers through his locks. They curled around me, lovingly, full again. Jordan was fast asleep. Translucency fell over and lifted from his skin in rhythm with deep breaths. I wondered, not for the first time, if he dreamed of the future.
The next generation of influential Black voices can be found on NPR's new collection, Black Stories, Black Truths. Black Stories, Black Truths is a celebration of Blackness from NPR. Each of NPR's Black voices are as distinct, varied, and nuanced as the Black experience itself. And every episode is a living account of what it means to be Black today, told from a unique Black perspective, from Bobby Shmurda to The Wire. Michelle Obama, to reparations, there's no limit to the range of Black Stories, Black Truths. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you'll find a collection of some of NPR's best podcast episodes celebrating the Black experience. Because stories should never be about us without us. Listen now to Black Stories, Black Truths from NPR, wherever you get your podcasts.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Now, let's get back to our story. 17. Another Keplin had been killed by peace officers for reckless use of telepathy not 3 days before. Jordan had seen the videos, had read the reports. I knew because I had shown them to him. How then could he be so stupid? I began to wash the dishes, something my own father would do when he was mad. He told me once that it was so he could have something to do with his hands. I turned to look at Jordan leaning against the wall. At 17, my only son was a head taller than me. His muscles were still wiry and tightly strung, a testament to the years of physical therapy I had hounded the insurance to pay for. Passing in a crowd, my son was no stranger to the curious glance or two. Lately, however, glances were turning to stares. People were noticing.
"Well?"
I said. How many times had I told him to be careful?
"Well, what?" "Jordan, he talked bad about Mom, Dad."
Jordan's skin changed as the fragmented words came out of him. Pockets deepened around his eyes and sent a shadow extending past his nose. A single tear fell during this transition, and for a split second, an intricate network of pumping blood was visible along the surface.
"Then you come to me. You don't go trespassing into someone's mind." "He challenged me. It was my right." "Oh, really? Is that what they teach you on that ship? These people don't care about your Keplin rights if they think you're a threat. Who else saw this kid bait you?"
"Nobody.
Just your word against his."
I held up a soapy hand before Jordan could rebut. I wasn't finished.
"What do you think would have happened if he called the PO? What would they have seen?"
The answer to my question flashed briefly through my mind as Jordan remembered. My legs weakened. I leaned against the kitchen sink. Though the telepathy was brief, its memory lingered. It was a wonder Harris Magnet High hadn't expelled him.
"Oh, Jordan, did anything break?"
"No."
"And what about the boy? Is he hurt?"
"You're worried about him? Do you even care what he said about Mom?"
Though his voice stayed level and well within his age, bluish purple spots checkered his skin. I slammed the table hard enough to make Jordan jump. A faraway, unimportant pain cut between my fingers. My son's skin spots bloomed.
"Watch your tone,"
I said. The spots lessened, but not completely.
"I don't give a shit about him. I care about you going out here and making a target of yourself. Now, is the damn boy hurt?"
"I'm not stupid, but he won't be talking about Mom anymore."
My son, was he smiling? I had been that same teenager, sneaking out to joyride, playing hooky, doing drugs, naively thinking I could be as carefree as my white friends. Dad's warnings that I would be seen as different because my brown skin fell on deaf ears. That is, until he made me listen. I'd avoided the jail and the grave thanks to him. I was determined to do the same for Jordan, even if he hated me for it.
"I'm pulling you out of Reliance this semester."
Jordan looked at me so quickly that if I hadn't been prepared for a reaction, I might have flinched. A sharp buzz touched my mind. A glimmer of metallic yellow flicked across my son's skin like sunlight reflecting off a morning tide. The air warmed.
"I know, son, I know, but this is serious. You could have been arrested."
"I didn't do anything wrong."
"They're not going to react to what you did do, but what you could do.
If I don't pass the spring exam, it'll be another year before I can claim citizenship.
Well, you should have thought about that before.
My father's phrase. Though I vowed he'd never meet Jordan after his treatment of Marlena when she was alive, here he was now, somehow still able to reprimand his grandson. Something shattered behind me. I didn't turn to look.
You're trying to trap me here. Earth is your home.
His skin, which was already glowing a faint blue, flickered as if there was a change in lighting. I ignored the foul language. Something else broke behind me. While the one before sounded like a glass accidentally tipping off the counter, this one held a fierce, intentional quality. A light wheeze that hadn't been present a moment before cut the air. His locks, usually thick with highlights, thinned and curled.
"You're working yourself up," I said.
His breaths were heavy now, past the point where he could self-soothe. His locks congealed into clumps.
"I can't breathe," he said.
The phrase heard throughout his life had never lost its ability to induce fear. I was at his side immediately, the air gone out of my anger. I began to undo one of his hair ties. He shrugged me off with a force I understood but didn't expect.
"Remember, if they get air, you get air,"
I said. For a moment, Jordan only stood there, tense with wheezes. I moved to step in, his will be damned, but then his hand went to his hair. He raked his fingers through freed locks.
"You all right?"
I said.
"Can I go to my room now?" "Are you all right?" "Yes. Now can I go?"
I stepped back and gestured the way. His first couple of steps were soft. He straightened himself and stopped outside of his door. For a foolish second, I thought he was going to make a joke and dissolve some of this useless tension between us.
"I wish you had died and not her."
My hand gripped the counter for balance. Jordan's door slammed behind him. The entire house rattled.
"Well, you know what?"
I yelled.
"That makes two of us."
I rubbed my bald head and leaned against the wall. The house settled. The heat of Jordan's anger dissipated. I lingered there for some time, missing Marlena. I remembered the last look she'd given me as she retired to bed that first night back home, seemingly exhausted from Jordan's birth, just a couple hours before a blood clot silently took her from us. She had known of her own mortality like every other Keplin, but had said nothing. What's more, being so close to death would have given her sight over all of Jordan's lifespan. I spent many nights wondering about that last look. What of his story had she seen? What was so important to protect me from that she left me completely in the dark? The world just wasn't ready. Wasn't it my job then to bend him to that world? Pulling Jordan from Reliance would delay his dual citizenship for the Keplin mothership, a steep price, but perhaps through this consequence he'd learn to be quieter so that I could enjoy him longer.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Now, let's get back to our story.
13.
The Stratovator rumbled as we passed through thick ozone. Below us, the cloud-streaked countryside dissolved into a shower of faint rainbows. A metallic grid replaced our view of Earth. Awe lit Jordan's skin. He'd never been on this side of the Tellurian Divide. And then, as if our minds were one, we both looked up. Debris littered the dark space above. Reliance, an oblong behemoth once alive with colors vibrant enough to ripple still photographs with life, now floated in the middle, its outer hull dull and gray. The Tellurian Divide ensured that most terrestrials would never see how a generation before us had nearly decimated the Keplin people and left them to rot in our orbit. Little of this history was taught at his Earthbound school, where he was recently suspended for going invisible after a classmate pulled his hair. My naive hope of raising Jordan to pass as terrestrial dwindled with each incident. Once considered adorable, his telepathy, his chameleon skin, and even his locks slowly became symbols of threats. By trying to protect him from this truth, I had made him oblivious and careless. Reliance and their Keplin-run academy could teach him how to control his abilities. They could teach him how to placate terrestrials. That was the hope, at least.
"Did we do this?"
Jordan said with his tongue. He hadn't used telepathy with me since I'd grounded him for going invisible. Talking shifted his filtering mask. He quickly adjusted it as if its malfunction would prove fatal. I had assured him that his natural locks would welcome the nitrogen-rich Keplin air and take from it whatever his body needed.
"Decades ago, yes."
My son stood silent for a long time. I found myself wondering what he was thinking. In just a few hours, he'd know a lot more about his history.
"Will it hurt?"
he said finally.
"What? The download? You mean emotionally?"
My smile was audible through my own mask.
"Dad, it won't hurt, son,"
I said. Marlena had told me about the passing down of history through experience. There was no storyteller, no interpreter, just raw, first-hand experience. They revisited the good and the bad from the glory days before the need for generation ships to the most recent terrestrial mandate that all Keplin human pregnancies in the first and second trimester be terminated.
"You were made for this."
I could almost see the words forming on his lips. "Half made for this." But he kept them in. The Stratovator docked. The airlock hissed, and we crossed over into one of Reliance's thin loading hallways. We went through processing, weapons scans, and telepathic probing before being cleared to pass through to the alien city. A shuttle that extended from the inner ship's transparent walls slowly made its way around to us. The vehicle felt alive, from the glistening of its walls to its rhythm of expansion and contraction, as if breathing. It also felt slow, old, and sick. In fact, the whole ship did. The shuttle dragged us along the ship's perimeter through the elevated strip of residential areas that housed the city's terrestrial investors, scientists, and the voyeuristic wealthy. A clear demarcation lay between this and the bustling city that filled the ship's expansive center. Jordan and I both looked out the window, through the transparent ship hull and marveled at our blue home, rotating silently on its axis. The moon, half shrouded in darkness, loomed large at the edge of our view. This side of the Reliance faced away from the debris, aesthetically acting as another Tellurian divide for the comfort of the gentrifiers who enjoyed this view. The elegant Earth-designed homes peeled away as the tram closed in on the abyss-facing end of Reliance. No Earth, no moon, just stars decorating space. We unloaded at a row of identical hut-like structures that seemed to shift with the breathing of the ship. I checked my navigation device and located the main learning center where Jordan would begin his studies to eventually achieve citizenship.
"Come on, so we can get good seats," I said.
Jordan stopped.
"We? I can't sit in on your history lesson? Dad?"
Once my favorite word, I was starting to resent it.
"I'm kidding. I'll wait while you're enlightened. You may want to lose the mask, though. You don't need it."
Jordan's neatly bundled locks shifted, testing the air. He then removed his breathing mask. His nostrils flared. He sucked down gasping, panic breaths. He'd nearly slipped his mask back on when the tips of his locks defied gravity and curled up and towards the sky.
"See?"
I said.
"Dad never steers you wrong."
A couple of teenagers, full Keplin by the length of their locks, the twine of their muscles and the mental hum around them, stood blocking the entrance to the center. I hung back, tense but apt. Jordan removed the mask still hanging around his neck in response to one of their gestures. After a brief exchange, he made to move around them. The shorter one pushed him back.
"Hey,"
I said, loud and more confident than I felt,
"leave my kid alone."
He turned their attention towards me and shrank a little. I was ready to rail into them about harassing my son, that he had as much right to be there as them, when Jordan's skin gave me pause. My son filled my mind with a single, weighty image of myself, standing there in my terrestrial mask and ID badge, exerting my power over the Keplins. Marlena had told me how Iumcio was stronger on board the Keplin ship. Now, more than ever, I believed her. I backstepped to keep my balance. Understanding came immediately, but too late. The damage was already done. The teenage Keplins held up their hands in submission. One of them, however, shot Jordan a look. He winced.
"What did he say?"
I said after the two had gone inside.
"That my father's a colonizer. Now can you go? Please?"
I waited under the shuttle stop and wondered again if I had made the right decision. The world just wasn't ready. Had Marlena meant my world or hers? Soon, my son would know all that had transpired between his mother's people and mine. Past the towering schools and housing complexes, I could almost see this history etched into the cosmos. The view became accidentally spectacular as Reliance rotated to catch the sun's rays on its solar panels. When Jordan finally came out, the sun looked to be in a slow dance with the moon. I stood to greet him, my apologies ripe on my tongue and primed in my mind to enter into our neglected Iumcio space. It took me a moment to recognize the deep anger in Jordan's skin. I'd seen this Keplin intensity only once before, when Marlena had been rejected by her dream birthing center because she was high risk. Jordan held that same glow now. Raised welts lifted and flattened throughout his body. Whatever they had shown him in there had left an indelible mark. I waited until we were in a private two-seater transporter that would take us across the city to process Jordan's application for citizenship.
What part got to you?
Every part. All of it.
I squeezed his shoulder. What could I say? That I had loved his mother? That I had been different? That I would have never done those things if I was in charge? I said nothing. It was his right to be mad. I felt all that shame and more in Jordan's look, as if I had been unmasked. In the few years following my son's departure from home, before the Keplin uprisings and terrestrial response had brought us close, I thought our connection had dwindled or even completely faded. How wrong I had been. The deep and new emptiness I felt now, in the bed, alone, the shadow of my son's last breath going cold on my cheek, I had not felt since before Marlena decided to yungcho with me and let me into her world. I could feel Jordan since birth, even when I didn't know it. The nothing now was deafening. I knew without question that my son was dead. I was still in bed when I received the call.
This is Peace Officer Candy with...
He couldn't breathe,
I said. A substantial pause.
He resisted arrest. We had to restrain him and...
The voice on the other end stopped the explanation because there was none.
He did not survive.
Where?
My voice broke. I bit it back. The emotion choked me. I couldn't breathe. This would all have to come out. But not now. There were things that needed to happen.
Where is he?
He was a registered Keplin and was traveling outside the usual area.
Where is he?
Reliance, per protocol. Look, I'm sorry for your loss. If he would have just...
I hung up. Nothing felt real. Most of all, I wouldn't be able to say a proper goodbye. With tensions rising to the brink of war, trans-atmospheric travel was temporarily suspended, except to transport remains of deceased Keplins back to Reliance, which meant that if Jordan had a funeral, I wouldn't be there. When Marlena died, she'd left behind a calming shadow of herself ever present in our son's eyes, the way his locks' many sensors tasted the air. The way I'd come to know his inner feelings from his skin tones better than any facial expressions or words could ever convey. He had been a living beacon of hope. Now, what was there?
You knew,
I said to my wife's memory. Of course she had seen. What else would a new mother do, faced with her own mortality, besides look to the future of the one she had just birthed to see if she could rest in true peace? She must have seen this moment, this failure. 25 years, and he was gone.
I'm so sorry.
The mental void left by my only son's death filled in a sudden, exuberant rush that pushed me up and out of bed. Rough, shaggy carpet pressed between my toes. My arthritic knee moaned in protest.
I listened to the unmistakable signal of someone I had only been able to imagine for the last several years. She had given me this message right before her death. A simple sentence, so quickly disregarded and forgotten then, but now so clear. You were so good. I couldn't deny it as a memory, but I couldn't remember accessing it at any time before. I lay there quiet, my dead wife's words clinging to the air. They didn't comfort me. In that moment, how could anything? But they gave me a sense of clarity in an otherwise obscure world. And then I began to weep, heavily and without shame. Seven days. Marlena labored for nearly a week. We were well prepared for the differences in a Kaplan birth. The hospital, however, wasn't. After a full 24 hours of stalled progress, they offered increasingly aggressive interventions. We successfully refused them in the beginning, but none of the anesthesiologists felt comfortable placing an epidural because of lack of Kaplan anatomical knowledge, and they were conservative with the pain medication. So when the pain became unbearable, Marlena agreed to the inducing medication and had a bad reaction. Clots formed throughout her body, including the umbilical cord. She had an emergency cesarean, and I remember hearing her pleading screams from outside the operating room. And then, silence. I was sure they were both dead. Not quite. Toxins had flooded little Jordan's lungs, someone explained to me afterward. He likely would have died quickly if not for his Kaplan hair. They took him to the NICU and her to urgent post-op recovery. Now, we were home. I cradled Jordan's head. The entirety of his small body lay along my arm. Beneath translucent skin, networks of blood vessels gave insight into the intricacies of life. His tiny mouth puckered for food, and when none came, he began to whine. Marlena was in the bathroom. She had been concerned about bleeding. I tried to hum a tune to soothe him. None worked. I put on the radio in desperation, flicking past the channels, and stopped when Jordan began to coo. The song, unfortunately, was just wrapping up. I picked back up the melody and began to improvise. Down by the river, where the kids play, laughter and sunshine till the new day. Till the new day, sun, till the new day. Laughter and sunshine till the new day. Daddy loves chocolate, daddy loves stew. More than all this, son, daddy loves you. By the end of it, he was asleep. His tiny arms hanging off his side, his small mouth agape. I carefully took him back to our room. My finger cradled the light switch and then fell away. I didn't want to wake him. I felt my way forward, grabbed the cold fabric-laced rim of the bassinet and placed my son down into it. A creak. I froze. Jordan stirred, then was still. The soft whistle of his breath touched the night air. Marlena was in the living room, waiting for me. I gestured for her not to get up. "He's fine," I said, sleeping.
Well, aren't you super dad? Only on weekends, I said. I slumped onto the couch, the collective exhaustion of the last week hitting me like a brick. How are you feeling?
Tired.
She was looking out into the dark hall, as if she could see the bassinet through the walls, and something about it unnerved her. Something was wrong.
You were so good. The world just wasn't ready.
You did all the work. I was just there to support.
She nodded, still looking off. Then she took a deep breath that seemed to bring her back from wherever she had gone. She smiled a smile that wasn't reflected in her tones, not from what I could see.
I'm going to get some rest.
Okay.
Of course.
We kissed.
I'll be here.
Less than an hour had passed when I realized the whistling had stopped. I went to Jordan's bassinet. His infant face was twisted in silent anguish. I'd already screwed up. Jordan wasn't born with the same vocal abilities as other terrestrial children. The physical show he gave now was an instinct passed on from me without the equipment. Marlena must have been too exhausted to feel his Yunkchio wail. I had been disappointed and more than a little jealous when his mind hadn't also immediately connected to mine. Give it time, my wife had said. It'll come. I hoped so. I lifted him from the bedding, took him out to the living room so as not to wake Marlena, and saw that some of his hair had twisted into his swaddle. I undid this and waited. The whistle returned long, low, and steady. I walked him for another half hour at least. He was on the edge of sleep when his midsection gurgled. Jordan's eyes blinked open. He looked at me with what could have been the beginning of a grin. In that moment, my newborn son awaiting his first diaper change, and my wife resting in the back room, ready to start our new lives together as a family of three, I couldn't imagine where else I'd rather be. Two things, and one straight from my own history and one from my present. You've heard me talk about my mom before, and, you know, my mom was from the Midwest, from Kansas City, Missouri, which in my experience is as much a part of the South as is Alabama, Georgia, or Tennessee. And so, when my mother married my father, she insisted that they make the move from the Midwest and from the South, where he was from, the stated South, Arkansas. She wanted to move to California. She wanted her black children to have all of the advantages of opportunity that she could possibly provide for us. And for that, I will be forever grateful to my mother. The other is from my present and conversations with my wife, Stephanie. In fact, we had this conversation just the other day, and she pointed out to me that there is still, in this day and age, an absolute imbalance in the way doctors and the medical profession treat black women as opposed to their treatment of white women.
They get no trust when it comes to prescribing pain medications during childbirth. It is amazing and painful for me to contemplate the continuing blindnesses that we still exhibit in this country where race is concerned. And then there is this continuing tendency for our modern civilization, this thirst for conquest, this unbridled expression of greed. I had the pleasure of seeing a couple of student films. I was the MC at the Directors Guild of America's Student Film Awards, and the five films made by these students were extraordinary, and one was made by a young man from Nigeria, from the Ogoni tribe, and Ogoni, a literal place, a landmass where his people are from. And that is where in the 40s, oil deposits were discovered, and Shell Oil and others came in and they devastated this land while taking the oil from it and leaving nothing but wreckage in their wake and sharing none of the wealth with the Ogoni people. It reminded me of the Keplin ship and that debris field on one side of the Tellurian divide. We try to hide our sins in the hopes that they will not haunt us in our dreams. And I guess on some level, those efforts are successful because we don't seem to alter our behavior. What we're doing here is inconsequential except for its impact on our own souls and on the process of our spiritual evolution as a race on this planet. This story touched all of that for me. And I can honestly say that this man, Justin C. Key, has touched a chord in me, y'all, with this story. He's fanned that flame. He has accessed a part of me that is now, once again, on fire. And I am determined, as best as I am able, to allow for this righteous anger, this righteous indignation to fuel me for the remainder of my life.
Our producer on this episode of LeVar Burton Reads is Julia Smith. She is the best in the business, y'all. Our fabulous researcher is L.D. Lewis. Always happy to have you aboard, my sister. We had additional research support this season from Talon Stradley and Josephine Martirana. Editing and sound design by the extraordinary Brendan Burns, who also created our theme music. My great thanks today to Justin C. Key for allowing me to read his story. You can find it in the collection The World Wasn't Ready for You, published by Harper. If you enjoyed this podcast, please tell a friend about it or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. Like I say, share the short fiction wealth. LeVar Burton Reads is a production of Stitcher and LeVar Burton Entertainment. Our executive producers are Josephine Martirana and yours truly, LeVar Burton. And if you want to find me on the internet, I'm LeVar.Burton on Instagram, at LeVarBurton on X, or you can simply go to LeVarBurton.com. You can also join my book club at fable.co/LeVar. I'll see you next time, but you don't have to take
my word for it.
Stitcher.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.